afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. Personally, I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics, like mercury, PFAS, pesticides, are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is Adam Nordell. Adam and his wife own Songbird Farm in Unity, Maine, which became central to the PFAS deliberations last winter after they learned that their organic farm was in fact heavily contaminated by PFAS from historic sludge spreading. With great courage and integrity, they immediately curtailed their food production and spoke up about this incredibly big and growing problem. Adam is now the campaign manager for Defend Our Health, working to organize impacted farmers around the state of Maine. Thank you so much for joining me today on What Mama Wants, Adam.
Thank you for having me, Kate. I'm so excited to be here.
It's such a pleasure. So let's get technical before we get really personal. PFAS is a class of thousands of man-made chemicals with particularly strong bonds that makes them useful for making smooth, non-stick and waterproof things. But we're finding decades later that they don't naturally break down in the environment. Thus, they've earned the name forever chemicals. Adam, I wondered if you could explain how PFAS particles get into our municipal wastewater systems.
Sure. Thanks, Kate. So what I understand, I'm not a chemist, I'm not a wastewater manager, but the wastewater treatment process is a process where water and whatever that water contains drains out of the whole watershed of a municipality, our homes, our storm drains often, many businesses and possibly industrial businesses, maybe on city sewer, and anything that washes down the drain at any of those facilities winds up at the treatment plant. And PFAS chemicals, per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are, as you mentioned, used in a lot of consumer products. They're used in a lot of industrial processes. And it turns out they're really nasty. We don't want them in our environment. We don't want them in our water, and we don't want them on our farms. But if they're in our consumer products, in our Gore-Tex clothing, our stain-resistant products, or maybe a child's bib that's stain-resistant or stain-resistant shirt, they are in some personal care products, some makeup products.
Yeah, those don't run when you cry mascaras, you know? That waterproofing really works, except for then you're stuck with it forever.
That's right. Not a good cost benefit in the long run. So any of those products that wind up washing off in the shower or washing out of our clothing in the laundry or getting scraped out of a Teflon nonstick pan, perhaps, going down the drain, collect in the solids or the sludge, also known as biosolids, at a wastewater treatment facility. And then the practice here in Maine and elsewhere around the country, my understanding is since the Clean Water Act passed and we stopped dumping sludge into our rivers and lakes and bays, has been to collect that sludge material and spread it on farmland as a fertilizer. And it does contain a lot of nutrients. If you think of all of the human waste, that's not so different from cow manure getting spread on farmland. But we are not cows. We're not just eating hay and corn silage. We have a vast and varied diet and take a lot of medicines. And then it's not just the toilet flushing that goes to the water treatment plant. It's all of those other sources, a lot of which contain PFAS. So it's recently come to light in the past 5 or so years that in Maine, we have a big problem. The sludge that has been spread on farmland was, and the sludge is still, contaminated with those chemicals. And once it's in the soil, it stays in the soil. Some of it winds up in drinking water, in groundwater, and in municipal water supplies, and it's caused a big headache for a lot of people here in Maine.
Yes, Fred Stone spoke about how that happened on his farm earlier in the season. So the human excrement that is used in what we call biosolids or sludge is naturally rich in nitrogen, which is helpful for producing crops, but that same sludge is also made toxic by the industrial waste, household cleaning products, plastics, and medicines. That toxic sludge was applied to farm fields all over the state, in fact, all over every state, thinking it was amending the soils with beneficial extras, but it was also sowing disaster. I wonder if you could tell us your story about Songbird Organic Farm, what it was like a couple years ago and what it's like now.
Sure. So my wife, Johanna, and I have been farming together since 2010. We farmed on leased land for about 5 years, first in Lincoln County, where Johanna grew up, and then in Somerset County in the town of Starks, a little teeny town along the Sandy River. We learned to farm there. We were part of MOFCA's Journey Person program, which supports beginning organic farmers as they develop and pick up their skills to farm. And after 5 years of building a business and learning as we went, we were ready to secure longer-term land tenure and get closer to our markets, which had mainly developed along the coast. We were selling organic vegetables and grain products to Maine's food cooperatives, most of which are along the coast. So selling chiefly to Rising Tide Cooperative in Damariscotta, the Belfast Food Cooperative, and a few other locations as well. So we wanted to get closer to the mid-coast.
Can I just say, if people want to see the kinds of things you were growing, they can see them on your farm's website, which is Songbird Organic?
That's right, songbirdorganicfarm.com. Our yes. website is still up. Our business is shut down, and we're no longer farming at this point. Teaser alert, but our website's still up there. And you can check out some photos of our grain growing and our vegetable growing. And so we bought our own piece of property in the fall of 2014 from a man named Tim Christensen, who was an organic farmer and a retired Colby College biology professor, really passionate farmer, passionate educator, and someone who really had a long view of keeping farmland active as farmland. It was really important to him in selling his farm that it be conserved in an agricultural easement so that he knew long after he was no longer around, the farm would stay active as a farm. And that was a poignant decision, of course, now knowing what we know, but was also very meaningful to him. He had been diagnosed with a fast-acting cancer and given 6 months to live at that point. So he made a quick move to find the next generation of farmers to steward his land, conserved it, and then he did pass away several months after that. That was the fall of 2014. Starting the next spring, we started learning about the soil, trialing different crops, continuing to build our markets. And we built our business there for 7 years. We settled on mostly wholesale production. We were selling sweet potatoes, cantaloupe, tomatoes, bell and frying peppers, garlic, some greens as well, and then growing a bunch of grain crops. And we had a stone mill on the farm, so we were providing fresh milled flour, cornmeal, and cracked oats to a 100-person CSA with CSA members baking with our locally grown and milled grains all over the state, including right down here in Portland.
That's cool. And that's community-supported agriculture. It's where you kind of buy into a share of the farm, right, for the produce?
That's right. Yeah, sorry for the acronym.
That's okay.
Yeah, so that was what our farm looked like. It's a beautiful location. It was a beautiful place to live. We started our family there. My wife gave birth to our child 4.5 years ago, and it was just a beautiful place to be, a beautiful view of some ridges that separate Unity from the Belfast area, just a sweep of deciduous and conifer trees along those hills. So a beautiful spot to be in and working outside. And that was the backdrop against which we discovered that our land was contaminated this past winter. Long story short, the state of Maine has an ongoing PFAS investigation coming out of Fred Stone's story that you mentioned, who I'm so grateful for Fred coming out and telling his story and setting all these wheels in motion. If not for Fred, I would still be drinking toxic water. My child would still be drinking toxic water. So anyone who cares about PFAS in Maine owes a great debt of gratitude to Fred Stone. He's incredible.
Thank you for saying that. It's heroic when somebody doesn't have to stand up and destroy their livelihoods, but chooses to for the benefit of the whole. At a time when I think most people in our culture tend to move to an individualistic drum. That was one for the team.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's had a hard go since then, but he was thinking broadly and thinking about the health of everyone in Maine when he made that decision. So thank you, Fred.
Yes, thank you, Fred. And the first time I ever saw you, we were still in the lockdown phase. You were giving testimony with your wife on Zoom to Maine's Environmental and Natural Resources Committee, and every senator and legislator was visibly sharing your grief. I've sat in on some of those live and some of those on Zoom, but I've never seen anything quite like that. It was powerfully moving and actually impactful. I wondered if you could explain the law that's now on the books in Maine called LD 1911 it's the most progressive law regarding sludge spreading in the nation at this point. In large part, thanks to you and your story. Like Fred's, it gives people a way to understand something that we don't have a relationship to, like PFAS.
So LD 1911 bans the land spreading of sludge and also bans the composting and sale of sludge in Maine. So prior to this last legislative session, we had some still fairly progressive sludge regulation that forbade spreading sludge contaminated above a certain level. So that got the worst sludge, which was honestly most of the material produced at wastewater treatment facilities around the state, that got rid of the worst, but it was still allowing some level of contamination to happen on farmland.
The trick with that, right, is that it's, you know, if you can only have 20, but you put on 7 every year, in 3 years you're at 21, and it doesn't go away, so you're just adding up.
That's right.
So just laying less than isn't necessarily enough. You have to do the compounding.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And as we continue to learn more about the human health impacts of these chemicals, lower and lower levels are understood to be safe. So the right thing to do in this case is to halt the practice altogether, which is what the legislature chose to do. And I'm so grateful that they did.
Yeah, hear, hear to the leadership Stacey Brenner brought to that committee. I think, if I recall, we were asking for X and she said, how about X minus Y? You know, even less than you're asking for, isn't that?
That's right. That's right. It was originally intended to close a few loopholes, but not be a full-on ban. And Stacey Brenner courageously took the next step and said, we need to re-envision what protecting farmland looks like in the context of what we now know.
My hope is that that is a roadmap for the other 49 states to follow when they're ready. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants. Less toxics and more health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Adam Nordell, man of many talents, formerly of Songbird Farm and presently campaign manager for Defend Our Health, where he organizes PFAS-impacted farmers and the broader farming community to articulate concerns and connect with resources. Adam, your understanding regarding local food and our connection to the earth is really richly developed. You talk about the value of locally grown food as offering us a sense of place. And I found that really interesting. I wondered if you could explain what you mean by sense of place and how that knowing informs how you're thinking about the earth today.
So a sense of place has been very important in my life since I was a child. I grew up in Western Montana, in the foothills of the Rockies, and place and connection to landscape were driving factors in my family's culture, what we did for fun, how we structured our lives, where we lived, and my parents' career choices were in some ways secondary to being in the place they wanted to live and raise my sister and me. So that's something that I carry with me. And as a beginning farmer, it struck me that the local food movement offered us a way to amplify that idea of celebrating and loving place and settling into a sense of place when we sign up for a community agriculture share and commit to working with a farmer for the season. When we shop at the farmer's market, we're investing in not only the livelihood of those farmers, but also their stewardship of the land. And by eating that food, we're bringing some piece of the landscape into our bodies and becoming more connected, more as one with our landscape. And I think that's really, really cool, both from an aesthetic perspective, like the sense of terroir, that I'm having a distinct aesthetic experience that someone across the country is not having, someone who's shopping at a national grocery chain is not having, but also sort of from a philosophical perspective, when we're eating locally, we have a really important stake in the health of our environment. We need clean water. We need clean land if we're going to have clean food. And we're always connected to the place that we live. But when we choose to buy locally, we're really expressing that and we're really experiencing it in a unique way, I think. Part of my interest in farming was to use food to sort of tell a story about place and history and connection. So some of the crops that we were growing were regional heritage varieties and reflected sort of culinary traditions in Maine. We grew a lot of dry beans, and there's a really rich tradition around the cultivation and consumption of dry beans in here, both from an indigenous perspective, those crops were obviously and continued to be grown by indigenous folks and by European descended farmers and Mainers as well. The classic baked bean supper has a really rich tradition. We were growing heritage variety corn and making cornmeal. There's a rich tradition of Johnny cakes and cornbread that people really connected with. So I was excited to give people a way of expressing what they love about the place that they live through their purchase of local food, and then working, processing it, having their own experience with it in the kitchen. And so sort of farming sort of felt like an art project that way, a community art project.
Oh, that's really lovely. I was just thinking about how, you know, 100 years ago, before there was truck farming, we shared that culturally with our local residents. And have you seen the cookbook, the Bicentennial Cookbook for Maine? And it's actually now 2 volumes.
I don't think I've seen that, no.
Oh, it's so fabulous. They gathered recipes from all over the state and from many different traditions, recent and old. And then you can cook those things. They come with stories and pictures. And it's about our local connections to our food, even if it's something that was cut out of the newspaper. And lots of people made that same dish because everybody liked it in those mm-hmm. days. You know, that's that area's local flavor.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. And you raised a very special kind of corn too. Flint, was it called?
That's right. Yeah, we were growing, for most of our time farming, we were growing Abenaki Flint corn, which is a heritage variety that comes from the Western Abenaki people in the Champlain River Valley, who are, you know, our cousins to Abenaki people who were farming here in Maine historically and live here today. So having that variety felt deeply resonant, I think gave people a connection to a deep sense of history. That was pretty neat.
It reminds me of when people take ancient instruments and play ancient music on the ancient instruments. And even though we are modern people, we really can get the sense, the flavor, and the food you were growing was really doing that, creating that sense of place and the connection between people. I mean, that's the place, right? That in part the people that share it with you.
That's right. Yeah. So of course, this interest that I had in communicating through food has this terrible irony that there was an element present on the farm and in some cases in the food that I wasn't aware of that in some ways reflects the same idea that food is always expressive of history and food is always expressive of landscape and what's happened on that landscape, both the beautiful things that have happened and the really hard things that have happened. And our farm was land spread with sludge between 1991 and 1994. The PFAS chemicals that were in that sludge are still in our soil. They're in our drinking water, and testing showed that they were present in some of the vegetables that we were growing and selling, and they're present in my blood and my family's blood now at a pretty high level. So it's almost as if the farm, I thought the farm was a vehicle for storytelling. And it's almost as if the farm was telling a story that I didn't realize was being told. But that's something that I get to grapple with now and I get to try to make sense of now. And I do think that it provides a good vehicle for advocacy going forward. The story is impactful, it's sad, it's angering. That we would treat farmland like this, that we would treat our rural communities like this. So there's good fuel for change going forward there, but it was certainly a sad thing to learn.
Well, you've really integrated the utter grief and loss from the experience skillfully to be at the place where you can talk about it like this now, Adam, because what could be more of a violation? What you were holding sacred, the land and the food, and the connections to people, you know, you were selling vegetables unknowingly that had PFAS in them to people you cared about and sharing them with your family. I mean, it's the ugliest turn of fates. And I think of the man who sold you the farm. He didn't know either, did he?
He did not, no.
And so he died of cancer at a young age after living on that farm, which is a horrifying story too. And you're right. The place is still teaching us a lot, isn't it? So now you're organizing for Defend Our Health. You're getting other farmers together to think about how you can work together, how you can access resources. Could you say a little bit about what's going on with the monies that have been set aside for harmed farms?
Sure. Yeah. So alongside LD 1911, which was the bill that we talked about earlier that banned sludge spreading and the sale of sludge-based compost in Maine. There were several other important pieces of PFAS-related legislation, including LD 2013, which set aside $60 million to deal with the PFAS crisis in Maine. And the three big areas of focus that came attached to the $60 million are an aid package, a safety net, if you will, for PFAS-impacted farmers, medical monitoring, and possibly medical care, as written into the language of the bill, for communities that are impacted by sludge spreading. So those include impacted well owners who may not be farmers, but maybe farm adjacent, as well as farmers themselves. And then there's money for research as well. There's definitely a need for more research, but a big pressing human need for farms not to go out of business when they have a viable path forward on their land, which many do. Many of my peers who came out as PFAS impacted this winter and spring are safely and responsibly moving forward with their businesses. They're doing a lot of testing. They've adjusted their growing practices. They're using new water, irrigation water sources, and they're producing clean food. So it's they're doing really, really challenging work with a lot of integrity and are succeeding. So the state of Maine is ready with that fund to support them in making changes to their businesses where it's possible to support them in safely producing food.
Yeah, that's really encouraging. And if people want to talk with you more about this, they can find you at defendourhealth.org under staff, along with anybody that would be willing to point you in the right direction. Adam, as a father, a farmer, an organizer, what do you think is best for Mother Earth at this point? What does Mama want?
I think Mama wants us to move slower and think about the limitations of our knowledge before we make decisions. I've been thinking a lot about the problem of sludge spreading and how it impacted my farm and the limitations of the knowledge that the sludge spreading advocates experienced when my farm was spread. Sludge spreading was presented as this beautiful idea, recycling nutrients, averting a problem of waste, turning a waste product into a resource. So it was actually, it was presented as an environmentalist-driven idea. Unfortunately, the assumptions were flawed. Unfortunately, we didn't have a way of knowing what was in the sludge. And with 2020 hindsight, I wish that we had taken a more precautionary approach. We had said, there's no way that we can know what's contained in the wastewater coming from every drain pipe in a municipal system. Without knowing that, we need to assume that it's not safe unless proven otherwise. So I really think a precautionary approach to the many, many thousands of chemicals that are in our environment would be good for Mother Earth and all of her residents.
Ask questions first, try it later. As you said earlier, we have a common destiny with our local environment. And I think that that comes from your deep inner wisdom. We're going to have to wrap up soon, so I need to close this interview, but can I ask you a few quick questions about your own personal relationship with the earth?
Sure.
As a kid, what was your favorite thing to do outside in nature?
I love reptiles and amphibians, so I was out catching frogs and snakes and turtles.
That's cool. It's forecasting of the future farmer. Describe a scene in nature when you have felt awe.
Waking up on my farm in Unity and seeing the sunrise over Knox Ridge and seeing the sun caught in the dew or in the frost, everything beautiful and sparkly and fresh.
What's one thing you currently wonder about in nature?
Something that I wonder about in nature. I wonder about hibernation. All of these fragile little creatures, how do they make it through the Maine winter and then emerge in the spring?
Me too. I think about that a lot. They're so hardy. And what is your favorite baby animal?
I think my favorite baby animal is a baby sloth. I'm pretty enamored with sloths.
From someone who suggests that we go a little slower. That's beautiful. Adam, you are courageous to speak out about your farm's PFAS exposure, even if it spelled financial disaster for yourselves. Armed with your personal experience, your kind regard for others, and your devotion to living in harmony with the earth, you're moving toward protecting people's health and the earth itself. Thank you so much for being my guest today on What Mama Wants.
Thank you so much, Kate. I love this show.
Oh, thank you. And thank you all for listening. What Mama Wants will be taking a little hiatus for a few weeks while the next season comes into focus. If you'd like to hear this complete interview or interviews from any of the 28 previous weeks, please visit whatmamawants.org or listen to this show as a podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.